woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Well, and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Rick Pappas on the board. S&P futures up 17. NASDAQ futures up 106. Do we have Professor Lou?
Lou, you there?
Yeah,
okay.
I'm here.
Sorry.
Can you hear me, Lou?
I can hear you.
All right. Well, then we're good to go.
I don't know what's happening. I specifically tested the speakers and microphone before we went on. Am I faint or what?
No, you're fine. You're fine. I was just I'm not getting the feedback that I normally get, but Greg will work on that. So what's up? What's going on with this airline crash, Ike's?
What an awful thing. I was sitting here last night looking. I'm just having dinner. And it started showing up on my my Twitter. I keep my phone open to Twitter while I eat to read if I'm eating by myself. And it just started rolling stories down. What I understand, you know, they had a helicopter that was flying in that, you know, restricted airspace, and he was crossing. You know, he's crossing the approach for that. I guess they switched him to runway 33, which is a north, a runway heading north. So they switched the guy to runway 33, and so the aircraft was making a left bank to land at that runway, and the military helicopter was crossing the river on a training exercise, and they asked the pilot, you know, they're flying under what's called VFR rules, visual flight rules, and they asked the pilot, there's traffic coming in, do you see it above you and whatever, and the guy said yeah. So they're almost sure he was looking at another airplane, because you know that Reagan's a tight approach, and like, well, it's like O'Hare at rush hour. You've got a string of, and it's dark, you've got a string of lights, you know, extending back as these airplanes line up to land, and they're 100% sure the guy was looking at the wrong airplane.
That's the did I read that, you know, obviously O'Hare and Atlanta are the two busiest airports, but that's supposed to be the busiest runway in the country.
Could well be. It wouldn't surprise me. There's a ton of traffic, you know, going in and out of there. I mean, you know, if you're flying into Washington, D.C., you would much prefer, if you're going into the district, you would much prefer to land at Reagan, because Dulles can be, you know, Dulles can be an hour and a half. It's like O'Hare getting into downtown Chicago. Oh, Dulles can be an hour and a half going in.
And there's no train, I don't think. Is there now?
There is a train out to Dulles now, yeah.
Last time I was there was not. But
I actually rode it about a year ago. It's, you know, why they didn't do that from day one, I'm not sure, but now both Dulles and Reagan have metro connections, but still it's a hassle, and you want to go in there. So it looks like the helicopters just screwed up. The guys missed the traffic. The aircraft was above them, and excuse me, and in a left bank, so the guy flying the airplane, who is in the left seat, you know, the airplane's turning to the left, so he's not going to be able to look. He can't look through the cockpit down to where this helicopter is. And, you know, the helicopter's low. He's got the view. He's supposed to be able to see what's happening.
Stupid question. Why are the windows on planes so small? I know part of it has to do with the, you know, the fact that they're up in the air and they're busting the wind and so forth. But, I mean, the visibility in there to look around isn't really much, is it?
Well, the windows are small because of air pressure. The glass and the visual material there is not as strong as steel or aluminum. So those are actually weak points in the fuselage. And so you don't want them to be very large, especially when the aircraft is pressurized. So that's one reason. I mean, I'm wondering if eventually we're going to end up with somebody in the aircraft, either one of the pilots or the aircraft itself, using what they're doing with the F-35. You know, so a pilot flying the F-35 has a helmet that really doesn't give him outside views. What he's looking at is a computer-generated view of the world outside the aircraft.
So essentially a bunch of cameras.
Cameras and sensors. So when he looks, his faceplate is down. When he's looking at the faceplate, through the faceplate, he's got cameras displaying all these images on the helmet, and then in addition he's got sensor information. So as he looks through the helmet, he sees other aircraft that are marked, you know, with red or green or blue. He sees he can see bubbles of air defense activity, things like that. I'm wondering if it's a virtual picture or a supplemented virtual picture. I'm wondering if we will eventually end up with that kind of, that kind of capability. Typically, we haven't had a midair like this in a long time, and the reason for that is that there's a system called the TCAS, Traffic Collision Avoidance System, that's on all these airliners, but I don't believe it's operating, and it, you know, it basically is a transponder system that talks to other airplanes. I don't think the military helicopter had something like that on it. It had a transponder that would have marked its position, but again, at those altitudes, you know, on a night like that, you're going to be flying VFR. You're at see and avoid. You're supposed to keep an eye out for whatever. The air traffic control was talking to the helicopter. I assume the guys in the aircraft knew, could hear the ATC talking to the helicopter and you know, telling them, look, you've got traffic at, the way they were flying, maybe traffic at your 1 o'clock descending, and look up and
look up. You should say get the hell out of the way.
Well, but their job, that's right, their job is to get out of the way, but what the ATC would be telling them is you've got traffic at this thing, that the ATC knows they're close, and you know, it's telling the helicopter you've got to keep an eye out.
If you are in, somehow find your ass basically in the landing pattern at Midway or O'Hare, and you're in a helicopter, how the hell do you get out of the way? You shouldn't be there.
They're allowed to fly through that airspace under certain circumstances, and this guy was crossing. I don't know the training mission, but that would have been cleared with ATC. They knew he was there. They were talking to him.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm saying, you're the pilot, but if somebody's going to cross the landing pattern at Midway or O'Hare in a helicopter, and I'm not saying if it's military, it could be the president, for God's sake, you're gonna stop the pattern until the guy gets across. You're not gonna say look out for planes.
Police helicopters fly through Midway and O'Hare airspace all the time. So do news helicopters. So do commercial helicopters. You don't stop the traffic.
Well, I misspoke. I didn't mean spot. I mean you don't send a slow moving helicopter in there and say keep your eyes around. You see somebody coming at you, get out of the way.
The local controllers are adept at this, and as I said, there are collision avoidance systems that are triggered when this happens. So I mean, they'll sort out that both aircraft are heavily instrumented. They were under observation at the time. They'll sort out what happened. But I think it was just a situation where they were moving, that they apparently had swapped runways, so that this aircraft had been coming in from the north, and they turned them around to land traveling north rather than traveling south, according to what I read. And the he was, as I said, making a left turn to come in on that runway. And
see, that's a little different than what I heard this morning. They had some dude on the way in, a retired NTSB guy.
Okay.
And he said that the plane was on essentially its final descent, and
it was.
And he says at that point you're not looking for any other traffic, you're looking at the runway. He goes, the question is, what the hell was the helicopter doing?
That's part of the, that's going to be part of the issue. Yeah. As I said, air traffic control was talking to the helicopter. So they knew he was there.
I guess what I'm saying, you're the pilot, it's 300 feet. If you're the plane, you're not looking to dodge anybody.
You're coming in, you're focused on landing. It's a difficult runway to land on. It's short. You have restricted airspace all around you. You're coming in, you're focused on that. They will tell you, oh, we've cleared a helicopter, helicopter, whatever its call sign was, Pat 21 or whatever. You've got an airliner coming in at such and such. And the general rules on VFR, if they could not identify the aircraft or see it, or if they're told the airplane's there, if they don't see it, their job is to stop and hold until they can identify the traffic. If the air traffic control tells them you're clear to proceed, VFR, which means here's an airplane coming and you're supposed to look out for it, and they do, and they miss the airplane.
Well, for those that don't, have never been to Washington, and Lou can expound on this, if you even go out and walk along, in any of the parks or jog or whatever, like I used to do, it's very immediately, you sit there and go, what the hell's going on with all these planes? Because they don't fly over the Capitol, they don't fly over the White House. They kind of fly up the river, right? Then make
that's right. They come up and down the river.
Yep. And they make some kind of bank turn, and then you're into the place. I don't think the runways are any longer than Midway, are they?
I don't know if they're as short as Midway, but they're short. I mean, when you touch down there, it's the pilots are on the brakes and on the thrust reversers right away.
Well, you're not. There's no way a 747 or a 777 goes in there, right?
No, I don't. Oh, I don't think they take anything in there larger than,
I'm going to say a 57.
Yeah, maybe a 57. But I don't think there's anything larger than that going in there.
They used to all be DC-9s and 727s that piled
right,
in there.
Right. And so, yeah, I mean, it's an exciting approach if you're going in there, because you've got Reagan right there, you've got Dulles. 15 miles away. You've got Andrews Air Force Base, which is very active. You've got Fort Belvoir in the south end, which is helicopters. You've got there's a Marine Corps Air Station there. You've got the White House with whatever helicopters are flying in and out of there. You've got DC police and ambulance. So there's a lot of. I mean, the only other place I'm aware of that has that many airfields that close is San Francisco, the Bay Area there, with the Naval Air Station there, and then San Francisco and San Jose, all
Oakland,
tight Oakland, all tight together.
We were on. I remember, this is so Washington. We had a meeting in. We used to have one board meeting. When I say we, the CBOE board used to have one meeting in Washington every year, right? And of course, it was dead middle of summer, and I think it was the July board meeting. So if anybody wants to get hot, other than maybe going to St. Louis, you want to be hot and humid, go to Washington. I mean, it's about as... There are those that would say the reason why all Franklin Roosevelt's, like the Social Security and all other stuff was passed is because didn't he call a special session in summer, and it was before any place was air-conditioned, and people actually were meeting out on the grass, and they said, we'll sign this just to get home, because this is so...
Well, it's the city's built on a swamp.
Yeah. Well, there used to be something called the shuttle, and I don't know if there is anymore. But if you wanted to go from New York to Washington, because people are going back and forth like there's no tomorrow, they basically took an old 727 and cleared out the kitchen, cleared out everything. It was just but seats and bathrooms. And you'd load the thing up, and as soon as it was full, they'd go. So there was no time. You would just show up and say, I'm going to New York. Okay, you're on the shuttle. And then you'd go, and you'd sit down. Well, we're heading from this, I think we were staying at the, what's the one, the Willard? I think we were staying at the Willard. And what we got to talk about history in that place. Isn't that the place where the term lobbyist was coined?
It's one of those places, yeah.
Yeah, because the deal was that was it Lincoln or somebody? Anyway, the White House was wrecked. Didn't the Confederates burn the White House or some crap? Anyway,
the British burned it in 1812.
Somehow or other, when the thing was getting fixed, the president stayed at the Willard. And all the people who wanted to talk to him hung around the lobby and tried to get him on the way out, hence the term lobbyist. Anyway, so it's one of those, 98-degree, 100 humidity days, so we pile in a cab. This is me and the chairman and the vice chairman and the president of the Seaboard. There's four of us in there. Thankfully, I'm the tallest, so I get the front seat. The cab has no air conditioning. So we're in our suits, right? Back when people wore suits. It's brutal. So we get out to National, and we pile in, and they had just taken off. We had the back seat, and you had to go in sequential order. We had the back seat, back row, and they didn't, in those days, they didn't plug the plane in an air conditioner while it was at the gate. So it took like 40 minutes for this thing to load up with nothing but sweaty bodies, and then off we went in front of the air, came out. Lou, I don't know if it was ever so hot in my friggin' life. It was brutal, that thing. But it was at National, and it's an easy cab ride to National. It's forever to Dulles, back before they had the train. Anyway.
It's not a short metro ride out there. There are lots of stops. As I said, I took it about a year ago.
Is the place still as screwed up as when I came out of there, Lou. This is the 90s. I was on the board and we were at gate like 40 or some crap. The place is huge, Dulles. It's not as big as O'Hare, but it's pretty darn big. And I must have walked by 30 gates that didn't even have a tramway. People had reserved them or bought them, and nobody else could get them, and yet nobody ever used them. Is it still like that?
No. Dulles, I mean, when I flew out of there, Dulles is jammed.
All those gates are used now.
They're going 24/7 because of obviously coming into the national capital. But that airspace is very crowded. I just that, and the Secretary of Transportation was sworn in yesterday, 2 days ago.
Yeah, something like that.
And brand new in the job, you're probably not even settled, and this happens. So, welcome to Washington and welcome to the federal government. So get to work.
Any chance of finding somebody alive? I doubt it, huh?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I understood as of just before the show started that they had not recovered any survivors.
I heard 19 bodies. They've grabbed them.
Yeah, plane went into less than 10 feet of water, but it was a. Yeah, so it was a complete crash and impact, and they were at about, I think they were at 200 feet when the
impact occurred. They head on the thing, or they snip a wing, or nobody knows.
I'm sorry.
They head on the thing, or do they snip a wing, or does nobody knows? Not that it matters. Did they bash into it head on, or did they snip a wing?
No. It hit. My understanding is it hit below and on the fuselage, but I don't know for sure. I mean, if you look at the fireball, you see the helicopter going slightly. Horizontal, the fireball of the helicopter going slightly horizontal before it begins to drop, but the aircraft, there's a flash, and then you see the aircraft drop. Now you're looking at it head on, but you see it drop almost straight down.
Do you remember that movie with Glenn Ford? Was it Collision or something? Was a private plane ran into a, that time was like a 707, and I think it was was one of the weirdest movies. With the movie started with this mid-air collision, and you're like, what the hell is that? And then they drop all the way back and go through like an hour and a half or hour and 45-minute movie of all the things that had to happen.
Oh, it's called Fate is the Hunter.
Yeah, okay. To where those things ended up in the same spot at the same time.
Yeah, I believe it's Fate is the Hunter. It may be that, or it may be another one. But yeah, it's one of those. same theme. It's a cascading series of events. Fate is the Hunter is a single aircraft accident where they do the investigation, and it's a cascading series of events where they ultimately end up, as they're taking off, they have an engine failure, and there's, because the co-pilot had spilled coffee on a console or something like that, the indicator shorts out, and so they know they lose an engine, but they get an indication that the engine that's failed is the one that was actually running, so they shut down the running engine, and of course the aircraft crashes. But it's a series of events, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 things that happen that cause this particular malfunction, and that's the end.
Well, anybody who's, I mean, I'm not even in a class of Lou when it comes to flying, but anybody who flies a lot, because when I was on the, like I said, when I was on the board, I would fly once a month maybe, and now I haven't gone anywhere in 10 years, nor I'm really anxious to. If you fly 10 times a year or 20 times a year for 10 years, there's bleeps going to happen, or there's going to be some, you know, what you consider to be close calls. And the idea that we go year after year after year without a wreck until today is really nothing short of astounding when you think about it, Lou.
Yeah, I mean, this has been one of the longest stretches in aviation history for us without a major incident, and for it to be something like this is very unusual because of, as I said, of our air traffic control system and the way it's automated and the collision avoidance systems that are on the aircraft, it's very unusual.
We had in my small experience, well, and my brother and Dr. J were flying, we landed, I think it was in Washington, and we had to do a go, and the guy who was the vice chairman at the time, Tom Asher, he was a pilot, and he had the window seat, and all of a sudden the guy's landing, and you know, we're coming in for landing, all of a sudden the engines go flying as fast as they can.
Yep, you hear the engine spool up.
And all of a sudden, the guy, you know, peels off to the left. And they go, oh, well, you know, we're just a little too close to that guy. And Tommy's looking out the window, and he goes, we weren't a little too close. We were almost on top of him. A little too close. And we were I was coming back from, where the hell was it? Jack or Jay and I were coming back from New York. We got struck by lightning.
And, I've been in an airplane that's happened to.
I mean,
it's exciting.
Well, I was in steerage, of course, and Jan is in a first class. I just happened to be looking out the window because it's pouring rain, and all of a sudden I see this lightning bolt, and I go, geez, it just hit the first class section. And I guess the guys up there, you know, they went white. But, it was fine. My brother and Jan were coming across Lake Michigan, and the guy had a trip on 737. Jan says they're flying straight ahead, and all of a sudden they're flying sideways. The guy goes, it looks like we got a little too close to that 757 up there with that jet wash. They didn't tell me it was a 757. You got to stay behind those boys. Jack goes, we're all of a sudden going west, and all of a sudden we're going north. And because the thing totally turned in the jet wash.
Yeah, that's at least, that's at least slightly controllable. I've been in, and I just read an account out of Australia where they had a misset trim button that they didn't recognize had been misset, and trim is a small control surface that deploys, goes in your rudder or your aileron to keep the aircraft, it adjusts for yaw and some other things on the aircraft, but it allows the autopilot and the pilot to fly the aircraft more comfortably. You don't have to keep adjusting the stick or the rudders, and they got the trim in a when it's deployed, it does affect the aircraft attitude. These guys got I think it was rudder trim on and in a max deflection position, and the aircraft began to slide to the left, and the pilot, now both pilots were not putting any input in, and they couldn't figure out what was going on, and if you don't catch something like this, and this thing starts to yaw, and then a wing goes down, suddenly you find yourself, and they were at altitude, so they had a little bit of time to react, but you could suddenly find yourself in an inverted aircraft, you know, in a passenger airliner and with your nose dropping, and you're in real trouble, and it happens very quickly. The line is, what was the line? Departure from controlled flight, and that, again, just a perfectly normal passenger airliner flying, and just one minor mishap or one minor miss on the way the pilots were setting their switches, and it, you know, the aircraft's out of control in like 15 seconds. It starts to do this. They start to see this slide develop, and they say, "What's going on? Why is this happening?" You start looking around, and the slide keeps getting worse and worse. And then, about 10 seconds into this, as they're trying to figure out what's going on, the aircraft nose drops, the wing drops, and now you're in an unrecoverable position, and it can happen that quickly. And that's kind of what happened with those two 737 MAX crashes. And because that situation was exacerbated because they apparently were, both those guys were, and I will say this until I'm blue in the face, both those guys were not trained up to you know, what we would consider to be U.S. standards, or their U.S. practices. They put the autopilot on as soon as they took off to conserve fuel, and the aircraft did its thing.
Hey, Lou, what happened to that F-35? Didn't one of those crash in Alaska?
I saw that. You know, there is so much software in that airplane that stuff happens, and I think we're still kind of sorting out all the interplay. I don't know what happened to that airplane. He had his landing gear down. I don't know if he was doing just pattern work, or if he was doing something else, but. You know,
or was it an F-22? It was an F-35, right?
F-35, right? Yeah. And I don't know. I'm still waiting to see what the report was. But you know, they don't. You know, they had one of those. They had one of those lost in South Carolina. You may remember this one, where the guy ejected, and the aircraft continued to fly on for like, I think, 20 miles.
Oh, I remember that.
And,
yeah.
And because it's a stealth aircraft, they couldn't track it.
Because
he had his transponder turned off, and it just flew on by itself, eventually crashed. But I guess there are certain indications that you get if you're flying the airplane where the software goes haywire, or you get some kind of a glitch.
Do you always turn the software off on those things, or no? I mean, if all of a sudden you say, if something's going on here, can I just go back to manual?
You can't fly the aircraft without it.
Really?
The software. It's like the F-117, the first stealth fighter. The software keeps the aircraft in the air.
Well, that I know. I didn't know that was that way for F-35s.
My understanding is that you know, if that computer fails and that, you know, they're backup systems, but I think your ability to control the aircraft is very, very limited.
Ugh.
You know, because the airplane is inherently unstable. The flight.
Well, I know
computer,
the B. Those bombers, they're the flying wing, basically. So they were unstable. That's why, you know, they stopped building them in the 50s, right? I mean, until the computer could make the adjustments that quickly.
Yeah, that's basically correct. Although they were stable, you could fly them, but it was a load to fly them, and if you put a lot of weight on the aircraft, or you try to put a big bomb load on it, it became more and more difficult to maintain stability. But I saw that video, that thing just kind of circling in. So two questions, Greg. The first one that I had was, did they lose engine power? Because that looked like that aircraft did not have its engines going. And then the second was, what happened at the time of ejection? Because if you notice, the pilot's parachute is well below the aircraft as you see the video of it coming down. So the question for me, at that altitude, the parachute would have deployed immediately. The question for me was, did the aircraft, after he punched out, did the aircraft go nose up and climb for a little bit? Or, because he's well below it when it's going by, which, by the way, if you're hanging in a parachute and you know that somewhere above you is an out-of-control jet fighter coming down on you, or coming down in your vicinity, that's a little nerve-wracking.
I would think it's more than a little.
Yeah,
Are the ejection systems any better? Like, do you survive them now?
I mean, they're 0-0. You can pull the ejection seat on the runway at with no forward airspeed, and the seat would kick you up high enough to get the parachute deployed.
That's got to hurt a lot.
I went through the simulated ejection stuff when I was in flight training, and it's a shot, but I don't know if our ejection seats do this. But when I was working in the former Soviet Union, I was touring at one of their aircraft facilities, design facilities, and they had what were we looking at? An SU-24, I think, the Frogfoot, or SU-25, the Frogfoot. And the ejection seats on the Russian aircraft, Soviet designs, have harnesses that I think they're loops that you put your hands, or that are designs that you can move around. But when you pull the ejection sequence, the first thing that happens is these loops tighten around your ankles and your wrists and lock you into the seat, so that when the seat fires, especially for high speed ejection, your arms and legs aren't flailing around. I don't think our seats do that. But yeah, it's a jolt, and you're kicked out of the seat. Now, some of the guys listening, some of my classmates who are listening, may ping you and give you more information on this. I think this ultimately may be automated at some point. Right now, the pilot has to initiate the ejection sequence, and you know, sometimes you can't. The aircraft is so out of control that you can't get your hands down. And the G forces are so significant, you can't get your hands down to activate the ejection seat. And I had a classmate of mine who, and I don't think I've told this story. This is harrowing. So he's flying a T-38, which is a high performance trainer, and he's with a student. So he's take it back. He's got a back seater, so it's a two seat aircraft. They sit one behind the other.
T-38 is what model? Is it an F-16? I mean, it's designed for something, only except as a two seat, right?
It's a trainer. It's old. I mean, it's been in service since the early 60s. High speed, supersonic. So he's out, and it's got very stubby wings on it, and it's a beautiful little airplane. He's out flying, and they are doing a high speed loop, inside loop. So they're pulling up, they're flying level, and you pull the nose up, and the aircraft goes into a loop, and they're flying. They're just doing some acrobatics. And he goes into the loop, pulls up, so they're pulling G, probably seven, eight Gs, and the wing on the right side breaks off, just separates from the aircraft.
You're kidding.
So what happens is the aircraft, the wing snaps off, and suddenly that side of the aircraft has no wind resistance, and the other side has lots, or air resistance, and the other side has lots. So the aircraft immediately begins a spiral motion, spinning around its longitudinal axis. At the same time, because that wing is snapped off and the aircraft is now out of control, the nose pitches forward. So the aircraft is actually tumbling forward, nose over tail. At the same time, it's spinning.
And falling.
The wrong longitudinal axis. So the G-forces were so significant that he could not, with that motion, it was so disorienting that he could not, and it happened like, you know, instantaneously, he could not reach down to activate the ejection sequence, and neither could the guy in the back seat. And he said he didn't lose consciousness, but he started to gray out because of the G-forces, and he was conscious of his helmet banging against the side of the canopy because of the motion of the aircraft. And so they're doing this roll, and he figures, I'm going to die because we're not recovering from this. And as they spin down in altitude, and the aircraft is again tumbling end over end and spinning, like a top around its axis, the second wing snaps off because it's not designed to take this. And when that happens, the aircraft spins, stops, the nose rolls down, and the tumbling lessens, and he can get his hand down to grab the ejection seat handle, and he activates it. And they they fire out. He gets injured fairly significantly because of the way the aircraft was positioned when the ejection seat fired. But they eject out, I think they ejected out at like 1,500 feet. They were at 10,000 and the aircraft had gone that far down. Anyway, he breaks both arms on the ejection because he strikes the side of the aircraft as he's going out. His backseater goes out just fine. And so he's in a parachute. He's coming down. I mean, he's conscious this whole time. He's got both arms are broken. He can't lift them. He's in his parachute and he's got his visor. He had his visor up because it was a hot day. So he's hanging in the chute and he looks up, and as he's coming down, he's coming right into a pine tree, a pine forest, and he cannot get his arms up to protect himself, and the chute goes into the tree and his face just goes bang into the trunk of the pine tree, breaks his nose, knocks him senseless for a little bit, and he's just hanging in the tree by the time the rescue, and his backseater lands a couple hundred yards away from him, and he can talk to the backseater who could get to his radio, and they get a rescue group in there to get him out of there. But they recovered the canopy intact from the ejection, and there were 28 strike marks on the inside of the canopy from his helmet striking the perspex so hard.
It's like it was in 100 football games.
Yeah, that it was marking the inside of the canopy with the helmet strikes. And the amazing thing is he remained conscious, so that when that second wing snapped off, he was able to actuate the ejection sequence. His backseater was unconscious.
Well, we had when we first started PTI back in 1991, we used to do all these seminars, right? And and then people would come in and we'd do stuff for the SIBO. We met a lot of, shall we say, incredibly unusual creatures. A lot of them became clients, but they were good people, good clients. Well, one guy has a MiG, and he brings it to air shows.
Yep.
So what he says to me, or he says to Danny, more buddy of Dan's than mine, he goes, this thing's got a little bit of a problem, though. And Dan goes, like, what's that? And he goes, well, it's a Chinese MiG. It's not a Russian MiG. And Dan goes, well, what's the difference? He goes, well, Chinese dudes are small. If I ever had to eject, it will pull. It'll take my shoulders off. There's not enough room to get me out of the canopy. Brother goes, and you're flying this thing? So the guy ends up, the engine's out, right? The motor's out. So he has to get a new engine. So they put the new engine in. And I guess you can only do so much running up and down, runway. You got to eventually get the thing in the air, right, to see if the engine's any good. But what I didn't know is, because you think it might conk out, you don't want to be over like a residential area. So when you take off from the runway, say you take off from, South Bend or someplace like that, you go straight up as much as you can, because if it conks out, you can glide yourself right back down on the runway, or think you can. I don't know, you probably know all this. To me, this was fascinating. Well, somehow or another, when it lands, it catches fire. So they run out, the fire guys run out, and they put all this stuff on there, and he's screaming at them, do not do that. Evidently, if you put the fire stuff on there, it contains the heat in the plane and just destroys
it. It's foam.
Destroys all the aluminum, so they basically wrecked this plane by putting the fire stuff on it, because it wasn't that big of a fire.
I have a classmate of mine who flies his own F-86 Super Sabre, and he had a similar experience going out of, I think, Indianapolis. But he took off and his engine failed, and he managed to get the aircraft. He was at a high enough, like 1,000 feet, and he was able to swing the thing around and just come back and, declaring an emergency, get the thing down on the runway. I guess he scared a bunch of airplanes that were, lining up to take off. And
well, if the thing just conks out and you've got all your controls, you're better off trying to stick land it than eject, aren't you?
It depends on the altitude. I mean, that aircraft did not have a 0-0 seat. So Fred said that when he lost the engine, he said two things. He said, first of all, I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to put the aircraft, if I did use the ejection seat, that the aircraft would would come down in a in an uninhabited area. So I wanted to stay with it and control it as long as I could. And he said, second of all, I couldn't remember, because he was thinking about what he had to do to fly the airplane. He said, I couldn't remember exactly the ejection parameters, but I was pretty sure I was really close to them. In other words, where the seat wouldn't get you up. Because if you're in a descent, a fast enough descent, the seat won't clear you from the airplane, and you won't have enough room for the chute to deploy. So he said, I couldn't remember exactly, but I knew I was really close to the minimums for ejection, so I wasn't gonna risk it. He said the airplane was controllable. I could.
Hey Lou, we got 10 minutes left. We're at 7 o'clock. We're having a couple of guys on that have been on before years ago. They kind of chased down conspiracy stuff or whatever. But they're one guy was in NASA, not NASA, NSA. And they are really bright on the whole thing about the Nixon administration. They were reporters during that era, I guess. And anyway, we'll give the whole biography when they come in. But I think
this is the Nixon Vietnam thing.
Well, this is where I'm trying to find out at the time. It all comes down to, I mean, everybody's been writing back and forth about, you know, pardons, and even the thing you sent me. By the way, thank you. I read. Lou sent me to say, I mentioned about it yesterday, that it had to do with a guy describing essentially the 14th Amendment and the first Supreme Court thing and the second Supreme Court thing and kind of some offhanded stuff some of the justices made in their opinion regarding whether somebody is guilty or not by taking it. And when I got done reading it, Lou, and I sent you the kind of a response, I thought it was sort of clear as mud to me. And the dude's conclusion, we need another Supreme Court opinion. I'm going, gee, we need another one. But so then when I got this thing from Cora, somebody wrote in and said, talking about the Nixon pardon, now it appears that people still research this stuff. That's why I want to talk to these two gentlemen. Think that he was actually pardoned for, well, I want to back up a second. Nobody really knew at the time, at least I didn't. You know, there was this break-in, and they broke into the headquarters, and Nixon tried to cover it up, and blah, blah, blah. But I never heard of a litany, a real precise litany of what the hell the guys were looking for. And I don't know that anybody really knew, other than the fact that they were in there. Because he was so far ahead in the election, I mean, everybody kind of thought, well, why is he even doing this? Well, now the chatter seems to be that they were looking for evidence that the Democrats might have had that he had tried to torpedo the Paris peace accords because he didn't want Johnson getting peace in Vietnam. But this is when he was running against Humphrey. But the only thing that could torpedo him 4 years later, because he was killing the guy from Minnesota, the only thing that could torpedo him is some huge crisis where he actually tried to torpedo the peace accords and it cost more people's death and things like that. Sort of like what people accuse Reagan are doing in Iran with Carter.
With the hostages, yeah.
Yeah, and so this has now become front and center. But now it begs the question, and it kind of leads into this pardon stuff, you know, with the Trump and Biden doing all this stuff that seems to be, you know, otherworldly to me. And the more you guys that are smarter than me try to explain it to me, the more confused I seem to be getting. But so I went back, and my thought was, wait a minute. Everybody thinks, or maybe they shouldn't, that Nixon was pardoned because of some long, what did he know, what didn't he know, did he try and, you know, about the break-in. If it turns out that it was something totally different and maybe way more serious, I don't know that people are all that happy with that. Are you?
Well, if it turns out that the pardon, and I was unaware of this theory until you mentioned it to me, if it turns out that the break-in was to disguise conduct that arguably cost another 30,000 American lives. I think that was the number between the time of his intervention and the time they got the ceasefire. Then you know, that's treason, and I think people would be pretty upset. But I don't have any evidence for that. My understanding, and I thought this was a perfectly good reason to do it, was that the pardon was issued to turn off the craziness that an impeachment would generate, and to end the inquiry. You know, we got because from Ford's perspective, you know, okay, we got what we wanted. You got your pound of flesh. Nixon's out of there, and we can move on. Let's get rid of this. We had lots of problems to deal with, and so that was my understanding of, you know.
Me too, and I think everybody else's.
And it made perfect sense. So,
but if I were to ask you, what were they looking for? Do you have any idea?
My understanding is that they were looking. So the break-in was at DNC, but they also broke into Daniel Ellsberg's office, and I don't think Ellsberg was accused of having this. Ellsberg had stolen those Pentagon papers, and that
right.
I think that's what they were after there. I mean, if they were looking for that evidence, I mean, that why would that not come out? You know, in other words, if that evidence was there, somebody knew about the allegation.
Well, we're talking about an era of 50 file cabinets. Maybe never found it.
But Tom, somebody would have known about it.
The paper's not
the sole evidence of it. Somebody would have typed up the report. Somebody would have put it somewhere. And so why would that not come out somehow? I can't believe it wouldn't have come out.
I would believe. I'm with you on that. What I'm trying to get to is, you know, I have a million questions. That's just me. Is all these people? Well, Trump's pardons were pretty specific, right? But I mean, on the other side, on the Biden side, what if somebody did something totally different? And now we're talking about guilt. Can you really drag Fauci in front of Congress now, as some people seem to think, and ask him about his testimony last time? And now all of a sudden he can't take the Fifth. I don't know, Lou. That's not all that clear from that thing you sent me. You have to talk no matter what, like they're going to put an electric prod on some private part or something.
They could, if they want to do that. I mean, he's effectively been pardoned. There is case law out there, by the way, that says for purposes of immunity, you don't get to accept.
Well, there is a difference in immunity and pardon, right?
Well, the pardon, yeah. So the pardon is broad ranging and specific, or broad ranging for anything you do, at least the ones that were issued by Biden. Immunity is for a specific transaction or a specific event.
If you get immunity, you're not convicted. A pardon, well,
no. If you got immunity, you can't be prosecuted.
Okay, so you're not convicted, but this is what I'm getting here now. This is why I'm being very confused, Lou. And if I'm asking confused questions, because I am confused.
Well, it's not just you, Tom. I mean that's why the article I sent you was from Jonathan Turley, and who I is a very good legal scholar, and that's why he said, listen, this needs to be resolved. The court needs to come in and clear this up as to whether, you know, whether you have to accept a pardon to make it effective, or can you say I'm not accepting it and you know, prosecute me anyway. I don't think the government, my personal opinion is, I don't think the government can prosecute you if you've been pardoned, whether you accept it or not. I mean, that's an official act of grace from the state.
We'll kick this around more next week after we hear from it. But here I'm under, this is almost like a name, image, and likeness, Lou. I've identified like four ways people are getting paid now, not just the one. It's if somebody is granted immunity, he's not even prosecuted, correct? No, that's...
He can't be prosecuted. Yeah, the state has specifically said, for this particular crime, you are not going to be charged.
Okay, and so now you feel free to talk to us about whatever stuff. But now a pardon, somebody's convicted. Lou's convicted of money laundering, and somebody says, it was a crummy deal. He's pardoned. But now, that thing is not taken off your record. It's still there as a felony, if it is, or a misdemeanor. Some you might not be able to get into Canada, right? I mean, can you? So it's still there. It's not.
Whether the Canadians recognize it, I don't know. But a pardon, as I understand it, effectively wipes the slate clean, and you are not considered to be convicted. That's the nature of the pardon.
Okay, so now there's other opinions on that. I happen to run with you. And then there's this sort of blanket pardon. We don't know what you did, but you're blanket. Well, you know, I'll give you your pardon. And that I really don't understand, to be honest with you.
That's what, you know, again, that's what Turley was writing about. Nobody really understands the implication of the blanket pardon.
Well, that's because, I mean, that's why the Nixon case came up. What if it was for right. something totally different than we even dreamed about?
And so this is I'm going to say something real quick, and then I'm gonna punch out. This is what makes, in my opinion, the prosecution Millie so significant, because Millie is they may go after Millie's pension and his retired rank, even though he's been quote pardoned, and it will be very interesting to see whether he tries to assert if they find out that he called the Chinese and engaged in conduct that was dishonorable or treasonous, and they say, you know what, you're not retiring at a 4-star rank, we're busting you back to colonel.
Well, can you hang for like one more quick question? When they say they're taking somebody's security detail, now if you're just some regular, I don't even know these people had security details, but if you're just some regular mope that somehow or another gets a security detail, I don't really have an issue with it. But if there's a credible threat from like the Iranian government against Lou, and I pull your security detail and they nail you, I don't want to be that guy. I mean, if it's there for a reason, I don't know I feel real problem with pulling it.
Well, and I mean, so the question that I would ask is, do we still think there's that's likely to happen?
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Do we think the Iranians are likely to do that?
I agree.
I don't know.
All right, buddy, have a good week. We'll talk at you next week. S&P futures up 12, NASDAQ futures up 97. Individual stocks, we've got Meta up 11. UPS down 18. We've got Microsoft down 18. We got Tesla rallying here for kind of the oddest reason, is they're now able to book their Bitcoin profit even though they didn't sell the stuff. So they put a $600 billion profit in Bitcoin that they haven't sold yet. And I don't know where that came from. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right
now. Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures up 13. NASDAQ futures up 99. Dow futures down 45. Individual stocks moving around. We had a lot of earnings last night. We had Meta's up 10, Microsoft down 18. It was down 26 at one point. We have Tesla was down like 18 on the original shot, and now it's up 13. Part of that was because this Bitcoin, they can take all this profit even though they haven't sold it yet. So there's danger there. But anyway, that's the story today. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX. See, my machine is a little slow here. European markets higher ahead of an expected ECB rate cut. Now, we did not cut yesterday, and Jerome Powell gave his usual sort of mealy-mouthed deal anyway, the DAX is up 64.3%, FTSE up 45.5%, CAC around up 46.6%, so CAC around sort of leading the way. Over in Asia, we've got the... why don't you give us a quick traffic, weather, sports, and we'll give a quick Asia, and then we'll... here we go. Nikkei's up 99.2%, Hang Seng up 27.1%, Shanghai down... Shanghai is still not trading because of the New Year. Neither is Hang Seng. So they last traded 128 on Hang Seng and 127 in Shanghai. So why don't you give us traffic, weather, sports?
All right, morning, everyone. It is 7:04 here in Chicago. We've got 31 degrees now, high of 50 today. Cloudy right now and throughout the day. Showers tonight. Phoenix, 42 degrees now, high of 62 today. So cool, but there is lots of sun. Traffic, Inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 12 minutes. Eden's from Lake Cook, 26 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 20 minutes. The Ryan from 95th, 18 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 19 minutes. NBA, Bulls lose at Celtics. That was 100 to 122. And that's all I got. Back to you guys.
Do we, yeah, this Tesla thing is pretty interesting. So we have both. We have both Wayne Manson and Andrew Craig. Gentlemen, you with us?
We're here.
I can't believe how I'm so happy you guys are still around, still kicking, and by the way, on the show with us. How is everybody?
Oh, well, I can speak for myself. I'm still here and alive, and that a lot can be said for that.
Are you in? You're in Florida, right?
Yeah, I'm in Florida.
And dodge the hurricanes, and you're okay.
I had to evacuate, but fortunately, no damage for me.
Well, good, good. Andrew, and you're still in Washington?
Not only in Washington, my office where I'm speaking from is right one block from both FBI headquarters and the Justice Department headquarters on Pennsylvania Avenue. So I'm keeping an eye on them through the Justice Integrity Project, and they're probably keeping an eye on me, although they're probably paying more attention to Wayne. So,
but have they removed your security detail?
I need one.
how does somebody, just out of curiosity, you wouldn't expect, you know, a general to have a security detail necessarily. Maybe you do. I guess my first question is, who gets security detail? How far down the rank does that happen?
Well,
okay, go ahead and share your screen.
Oh, somebody else is on.
I'll get off the phone.
Is it Wayne or is Andrew? Somebody's in the background.
Not here.
I'm by myself.
some lady's talking from somewhere.
The issue with the security details.
You got to go down.
Apparently, there were.
The green.
Cheers. Yeah, I'm hearing some feedback too. There were some threats made by Iran against Millie. John Bolton and
Pardon me, guys. It may be that I'm the cause of this. And cut me off for a moment here.
Okay.
Going through my boring chronology.
Please cut me off.
Greg, can you cut Andrew off? And leave Wayne on?
Right.
Okay.
There you go. You're back, Wayne. You're good.
I'm here.
Yep.
Why do I think that the FBI a block away maybe got in on a Zoom call and was providing some audio interference?
He pay no attention to the AT&T truck behind your telephone pole.
but on the security details are provided on an ad hoc basis to people who have received significant and verifiable threats from other parties. In this case, Millie, Pompeo, and Bolton had received credible threats from the government of Iran over the killing of General Soleimani.
Okay. That was the guy they knocked up. Was that in... They got him in Lebanon or someplace?
In Iraq.
Okay. So what Andrew comes back at him as I'm working my way through all this pardon stuff, and then which is getting more confusing the more I look, and we have two or three really serious attorneys on the show, Wayne, and everybody, everybody seems a little bit sort of confused as I am. I mean, it's like everybody, the opinions of whether it's an admission of guilt, not an admission of guilt, where they can make you testify, where they can be pardoned for something you never really been accused of, all this kind of, and then it got me to the, I thought of you guys when I got this note from Quora Digest where he sent me stuff, that now the current thought process, or some of the new thought process in the Watergate situation, and I know you guys did a lot of work in that area, was I never actually knew what they were looking for in the Democratic office. And I don't know if anybody really did, because he was so far ahead in the election, people thought this is the dumbest thing anybody ever did. Now the thought seems to be that they were looking for evidence that the Democratic Party had picked up that he had tried to torpedo the Paris Peace Accords during the first election, which was very close. And the second election wasn't going to be close at all, but they were afraid that if this would all of a sudden surface a couple of months before the second election, and it turns out people would say, gee, a bunch of people got killed because you screwed around with this, it might even have torpedoed him in the second election because he was somewhat paranoid to start with. So then the question, what the pardon comes up is, okay, we think he got pardoned just because of the cover-up and we don't want to go through the whole mess. If it turns out that this is what he really got pardoned for, I don't know if people would have gone for that at all. So that's kind of where I came to you guys.
I'll segue to Andy because he actually has worked closely with some of the original investigators of the Watergate scandal, and there was definitely something the burglars were looking for, but it's a little bit more salacious than finding out about, you know, skullduggery with the Paris peace talks. So
we have Andrew back.
Yes, I'm back. If you can hear me.
Yes, we can. You sound good. So we're digging into what exactly were they looking for in the demo, which nobody ever seemed to know, Andrew. Other than everybody's focused on the cover up, and then Nixon got pardoned, and it was all over pretty much. What is your opinion on this?
Well, the first and most important opinion is you're asking exactly the right question. And when Wayne and I start talking to people to assess what do they know and when do they know it, often with fellow reporters, that's the first question we ask is, okay, you think you know the Watergate story? What were they looking for? Exactly what you said, Tom. And who ordered it? Absolutely nobody seems to know except the authors of a number of books, and I brought them up here to quickly reference, but there's about 15 books about this, Tom, that answers the question, but they don't really get reviewed or reported because they answer the kind of question you ask. And by the way, let me apologize for the interruption.
Oh, no problem.
It was in fact me, because I have a radio show also, and 2 years ago, we had the first confrontation ever between Washington Post people and critics of the Washington Post original story. And I was trying to reference that for this discussion. And my sound manager, it happens, was giving instructions on Zoom to the guest, Barry Sussman, the editor of Woodward and Bernstein at the Washington Post, who was a guest and answered critics. So let me get to your question.
Andrew, before you did, and I apologize for this, but I'm going to blame George Stigler for this. You always want to back up and start over. What, in today's world, we get a gentleman like Greg on the board, today's world, a break-in is you steal somebody's computer, you grab their laptop, and you're out the door. In those days, what did the DNC look like? Are we talking 100 file cabinets? I mean, how would you even go about finding something?
Well, that goes to your question. So let me explain the layout, and then we'll get to the exciting and salacious answer to your question. First of all, it's an office building or an office suite. It's got a lot of boring stuff about campaign stuff. And the head of the Democratic Party, Larry O'Brien, was actually based in Miami. So he's got a nice corner office, but he's not there hardly ever. And the break-in wasn't even anywhere near his office. It was at the other side of the building, where it actually, in a sense, was the Democratic National Headquarters. But how many of your listeners or even reporters covering the White House know that it was sublet to a smaller entity, the Democratic Governors Association?
Really?
So it wasn't even, in a way, the Democratic National Committee. And the other thing, how many people know that the break-in occurred at an empty office? I mean, that's where they were arrested. And if there was video, and sometimes for our demonstrations, we'll hold up a key and say the key is the key. Because one of the burglars, Eugenio Martinez, one of the Cuban burglars, was, when he was arrested, he tried to swallow a key. And one of the arresting officers said, "No, you don't. What do you got in there, your mouth?" And they made him spit it out. And the key fit into a lock in an empty office.
Really?
And so this goes to your question, Tom. What were they looking for? Why would they not even be in Larry O'Brien's office or anywhere near it? Why would they be in an empty office? And what's the big deal about the key to swallow it, which can't be
that comfortable? I'm still thinking about what happens 2 days later with that key.
Well, yeah. And by the way, Martinez, a former, you know, he's a Cuban exile, longtime asset for the intelligence agencies. He went to his death, and he never said what happened, because that's how important it is. All right, so here's what a best guess of the alternative view of Watergate was, is that there was a ring of escorts, and there was a book showing the escorts, pretty young girls in Washington, many of them with low-paid office jobs, who wouldn't mind going out with men visiting the city for the evening.
Foreign guys? Foreign guys or business guys or both?
Democratic politicians.
Ah, okay. All right.
Or, you know, they come into D.C. and, you know, at its most benign, Wayne and I have looked into this kind of thing for decades long, and it enhances somebody's stature when they go to meetings and there's a pretty girl on their arm. Receptions.
Arm candy, as we call it.
Yes.
Yeah, what a man. Oh, he's always got a different girl and they're all good looking. This works. And if there are extra fringe activities, okay. But it's part of the coin of the realm to look macho, younger, with it, attractive.
But these are at least of age, not Epstein.
Yeah. And so there was a book, and it's been chronicled in a great book that people should just be aware of, called White House Call Girl. And it's written by Phil Stanford, and it's the diary of basically the madam who arranged this stuff. Her name is Heidi Rankin, and her boyfriend was the head of what passes for a mob.
But Nixon was ahead by 25 points. He didn't need any of this to get elected.
No, and that goes to the second question. Who ordered it? Nixon. Everybody kind of thinks that Nixon did, or at least John Mitchell did. And why do we think John Mitchell did? Mostly because of the whistleblower, John Dean. So, you know, the world awaits the great whistleblower, the White House counsel, John Dean, saying, yeah, it was, you know, Mitchell.
Mitchell was what? What was his job?
Former Attorney General.
Okay.
Head of the committee to reelect the president. But there's a lot of evidence that's emerged through these books that are not reviewed in the mainstream press that it really wasn't Mitchell who ordered it, and Nixon didn't know anything about it. Why would he? That it was Jeb Magruder, who was the deputy to John Mitchell, who ordered it. Now, the question would be, why would Magruder do it? Well, the gist of some of these pioneering kind of whistleblowing books is that it was John Dean who encouraged Magruder to order it.
Magruder, that name is very famous. Why is it? Am I forgetting why it's famous, but it's famous.
Well, he's the number two person at the committee to re-elect the president.
Also known as Creep.
Creep, yeah. And so if let's take as a supposition that John Dean encouraged Magruder to organize this break-in, why would Dean do it? Well, here's the money question. Because there's a lot of evidence that Dean's then-girlfriend, Maureen Biner, later his wife, was one of the escorts.
That's how he met her?
Well, we don't quite know. I don't know how he met her, but she was definitely part of that circle of escorts. In fact, this book I mentioned, White House Call Girl, by Phil Stanford, The Real Watergate Story, shows that Heidi Rankin, the kind of madam or mastermind of this operation, was a very close friend of Maureen Biner, later Maureen Dean. And there's pictures of them together. I'm leafing through the book right now show them at a wedding reception together.
Didn't they make a movie like this, like Pretty Woman? Didn't he marry the call girl?
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
This is an age-old story in Washington, D.C., and this type of stuff continues to this day.
Yeah, exactly. Here, I found the picture. John and Mo get hitched. And here's the picture. John and Maureen Dean get married with Heidi as a bridesmaid. And Heidi is a very presentable woman, and in fact, a former stripper, but she could look good, and she had a rare talent, as this book describes, of being able to go to bars and meet other pretty girls and finding out who's just out for a drink and who wouldn't mind picking up a few extra dollars to be on the list.
So in today's world, when you get the women in Congress, they set them up with a young guy?
Well, that's a different story. it's part of the same old story, Tom. But to stick with this for a few more moments, questions. So here's a logical question you might have, and many listeners. How could this possibly be part of the real story? This is only part of it, because remember, and I'll put this aside, but I'll just do a bullet point on it. Remember that you have intelligence agencies involved here with burglars and everything else. Well, just a hint of where that's going, and then we'll return to the main theme. Well, if you have visiting politicians and escorts, this would be a wasted opportunity not to have video. Right, Tom?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, part one of the love nests was at the Columbia Apartments, which I've paced off, is about 200 yards from Watergate on Virginia Avenue here in D.C. So it's all a very convenient little session until something explodes. And one of the things that exploded is that in February 1972, the pimp for the operation, Phil Bailey, who was kind of a low-end lawyer who decided to augment his specialty of representing prostitutes in court by getting involved in the ring. Well, he was busted, and all his files were seized by the vice squad. And apparently John Dean heard about that and said it's a national security matter, and he calls in the cops and he seizes the files, which presumably include
stuff on his girlfriend, and the gears start clicking. Now, all of this has been written about in books, and let me get to the main question that you and your listeners probably have. If what I'm saying is even close to the truth, why aren't there lawsuits against any of these authors, me, or anybody else who says this? Because John Dean is on TV, he's a respectable person at this point, an accomplished bestseller, his wife of 50 years is doesn't need this aggravation. Why aren't there lawsuits denouncing this? Well, here's the answer. There were two major libel lawsuits brought in Maryland 30 years ago, and the Dean family lost both of them.
Really?
Because a pioneering author, not the first, but maybe the second, actually two authors, one Len Kolodny and Robert Getlin, wrote a book called Silent Coup, The Removal of a President. And it was their very controversial thesis in a book that did sell a lot of copies that various powers that be that did not like Nixon used this situation to take him out. And they were sued, including by the Deans. And the suits were thrown out. And so that meant other people could comment on this. So I'm going to stop there and let you...
All right, so wait a minute. We've got guys breaking into the opposite end of the floor. We're not even where the committee was. And they had a key for a room that was empty. And the guy tried to swallow the key and died while we were saying where the key... And now we're thinking it had to do with the Democratic people having films and stuff on a lot of politicians that...
No. Not that the Democrats had films. That they were going out with escorts while they're away from home in Washington, and that intelligence operatives thought, well, this might be good to record.
Because for black men. Black men.
But I mean, but so it had nothing. I mean, it had nothing to do that Nixon was going to blow a 25-point lead because of anything these guys found.
Right. And by the way, that that story has resurfaced in another context, and there's an excellent book by Craig Unger that I've got right here, Den of Spies. He worked 30 years to document that. But what you said to open this segment and just repeated about Vietnam peace negotiations, that may be a true story, but there's no link that I know of that convincingly links it to Watergate.
Okay. But it might have been... actually, the thing I read doesn't link it to Watergate. Well, it did. It said they were looking to see if the Democrats had any evidence because they were... Somehow they got an idea... But if this were all of a sudden surface, it actually could torpedo his huge lead.
Well, I read that article that you shared before the program, and what it doesn't say is who's making that claim and what their evidence is. So it's taking an independent fact and pure speculation. Somebody's making the link. But in all of these situations... The facts are clouded by kind of phony articles, phony books, phony commentaries that muddy the waters. And so we always got to say, well, who exactly is saying this?
Well, the question that, I mean, whatever happened back there, I mean, you know, it sort of happened. But I think what, for purposes of today's confusion over the last, I'll say, month, about pardons in general, is the implication for every man America, which would be me, is that Ford pardoned him for something that we thought, okay, we don't want to go through this mess, we don't want to drag this out. Ford's got enough problems, enough things on his plate, and he just, the hell with it. I mean, Dick Nixon suffered enough. But if it was something totally different, like now. I mean, for instance, Biden pardons one of his, Miley or something, or whatever, his son or someplace. And we say, okay, whatever Miley did, we don't want to go dragging this thing. We don't want the Joint Chiefs of Staff on trial, blah, blah, blah. What if, he did something totally different that only Biden knew about, that nobody has any idea what it is? I mean, it's these general pardons are kind of odd. Well, what else is there? How does that not come to the tip of your tongue?
Well, yeah, this whole pardon situation is something Wayne and I've looked into quite a bit. It could be unknown, unexplained problems, and it's worth pursuing even after a pardon for investigators like us and commentators like you, what might be there. Let me go back to the original Nixon pardon briefly, and because it's partly how I got focused on this, and partly it goes right up to the present, because in what year was this? Probably, well, it goes back in time, but Roger Stone wrote a book called Nixon's Secrets, and let me look at the date, 2014, and in it he has a completely different view of the Ford pardon than what is conventional wisdom. He says that Nixon basically blackmailed Ford, and he presents evidence of that. And in it, he says that Alexander Haig was detailed to go to Nixon and try to work out the pardon, and that Nixon said, if I don't get a pardon, I'm going to take every one of these, and a lot of foul language in the Stone quote, I'm going to take them all down with me, and I need a complete pardon. And that's totally different than the conventional history. And as evidence, Roger Stone, who of course continues to this day in prominence, he quotes somebody in Florida who says Haig in retirement told him this story. And what's not confirmed is, does this retiree in Florida exist, and is it verifiable? But let's peel it back. So here's Roger Stone, who worked in the Nixon White House, and as his attempt in 2014 become kind of a legitimate historian and write this book, Nixon's Secrets, he's got this totally different view of the pardon. Well, let's peel it back a little bit. Now, Wayne and I have become friends of at least three of Roger Stone's ghostwriters and researchers. And one of them for this book was Len Kolodny, who wrote this original book, Silent Coup. And Wayne and I went and visited Len Kolodny in Florida before he died, and it was kind of a testimonial to him, and we became friendly to him. And I first met Roger Stone when this Nixon's book came out, and somebody had told me that Stone had a copy of a book I'd written, Presidential Puppetry, on his coffee table. And I wanted to meet Roger Stone and ask him why he had a copy of my book that he was tweeting out. And we kind of hit it off, and he said, oh, I love your book. And I bought his book. He signed it and everything. And I'm reading this alternative view of Watergate in 2014. And I think this is totally different than what we know about from reading the Washington Post, the New York Times, and anything else. So that's why I got involved. But here's the but, and then I'll turn it back for your questions, not to yak too much here, Tom. But you start digging into this, and one, you see, well, Stone actually has sources on this stuff, but he's also got all kinds of motives. I mean, part of it is he wants to establish himself as a historian as well as a dirty tricks guy himself. He wants to rehabilitate Nixon, but that doesn't mean he's wrong on this, because actually there doesn't seem to be any evidence that Nixon ordered it or knew about it. Why would he know about this stuff? But he was doing so many other things, Tom,
yeah,
that once it looked like a scandal, the cover-up began. And that made him vulnerable to people who both disliked him politically, but also if people could expose him on the cover-up, they could take him out. And there's a couple books written about that.
And let's go to break. When we come back, let's continue on this a little bit, but I also want to bring it forward to today and kind of what Trump is doing. It's been kind of an awful long time, and I've talked to a few people. I was talking to a guy last night, and the amount of people that are all in to this Trump thing, and it really wasn't all that hard for Trump to essentially tell people everybody in Washington's useless. I mean, it's hard for people to think everybody's useless, but it seems like, his people's view of their government is seemingly almost at an all-time low. And want you guys to kind of continue from the all the way through Nixon to here. Plus, we still don't really know who shot Kennedy. I mean, people's view of this of the swamp, it was real easy for Trump to tap into that. And let's talk about that a little bit. SBFuture's up 14. NASDAQ's up 106. Go to a short break. Just to bring people up to speed, and we had the Fed thing yesterday, and we'll talk about that when we get back.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right
now. Well, we're back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures up 12, NASDAQ futures up 91. We'll be real quick here. We've got some stuff that's moving. We have actually 10-year notes are down. Down to 4.51. It's down 41 basis points. As the GDP grew at a 2.3% pace in the fourth quarter, less than expected. I don't know. I haven't been able to spot the deflator yet. I don't necessarily believe that number. But we have gold is rallying here. Is up $30. $28.24. It's above 2,800. Silver up 75 cents. $32.14. So big moves in that stuff. We've got crypto up 782 at 104. 9.61, and we've got oil down 12 cents, real quiet here in the lower. This oil got quiet awful fast, didn't it, Greg? It shot up from the high 60s to the mid-70s, and now it's just kind of falling back down to the low 70s and just kind of stuck. Oil traders must be bored, eh?
No, they yesterday was wild.
Really?
Today's just, yeah. Yesterday was huge ranges.
Well, yeah, we did have a move yesterday. And yeah. What the Fed speaking, you always get that. All right, what do you got for us real quick, traffic, weather, sports?
Real quick, we have 32 degrees outside. High of 50 for today. Showers tonight. It's going to be cloudy the whole day. Phoenix, 42 right now. High of 62 today. It's going to be cool. Lots of sun there. Traffic-wise, we're inching up here. It's getting worse. Inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 24 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 38 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf looks to be 39 minutes. And the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 34 minutes. NBA news. Bulls lose at Celtics. That was
That's not news.
And, yeah, they lost by 22 points, 122. And that's all I got. Back to you guys.
Wayne and Andrew, Greg and I were talking, and we sit there and go, okay, why are we taking people's time this morning to talk about something that was, you know, how many years ago, 50? And now we have Trump letting loose. You guys probably know the answer to this. Did he let out every assassination file unredacted, redacted, parts of them? Are they still redacted? What do you guys know?
Well, let me jump in, and I'm going to be a lot briefer than my comments than before.
Okay, can I ask the question real quick, Wayne? So I'm saying, is the stuff we're talking about is, you know, it's stuff in a country. The Nixon thing was the first president that ever resigned. It was a massive deal. And here we are 60 years later wondering what the hell happened, which is a little bizarre, right? And now we're talking about a president getting shot, which was really something. By the way, who the hell killed him? I mean, I think a lot of people's disgust with government that you see today in these elections and everything else, not saying the winners or the losers, is this is all starting to sort of compound. Are we that screwed up? I guess is my question.
I would just interject that I think a lot of the blame goes to the media, and I think it goes. You can blame the media back in 1963 with the JFK assassination, accepting too many things from quote unquote official sources as bona fide reality. We saw it with Watergate. A lot of people don't realize that Bob Woodward, one of the star Watergate expose reporters at the Post, had before he was at the Post been a naval intelligence officer running message traffic between the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Henry Kissinger at the White House. That's certainly something he never admitted to. And what happened last night in Washington with the plane collision with the Black Hawk helicopter reminded me of what happened in 72. When the United Airlines flight landing at Midway in Chicago crashed, and Dorothy Hunt, the wife of one of the Watergate burglars, was killed in that. And there were reports that she was carrying a briefcase full of cash and $100 bills to pay off people. Not to talk about what they knew about the Watergate break-in, and even now this morning, with the incident at National, people are pointing to a McClatchy report that came out last night that one person had been treated and released from the aircraft, Washington. Metro Washington Airport's authority said several people associated with DCA staff, DCA is National Airport, were among the victims. And NBC, Channel 4 in Washington, and News Nation said four passengers and one crew member were rescued. How in the world, when there's no survivors, where does this kind of stuff come from? And this is coming from corporate media. They should know better. Now, all that's going to do is it's going to create another conspiracy theory well, what about all this? Because the media jumped the gun, or they didn't have their facts straight, or maybe they did get some information, and part of it was true. And I think we can look at all these incidents, the attempt on Trump's life in Butler, where there's still more questions about that. And I fault the media on stuff like this for either being too close-minded or taking official information and putting it out as sort of an echo machine.
I agree.
Yeah, because right now, I mean, the total lack of any, I mean, I think most people that have, you know, have half a brain, I shouldn't say that, realize in any bureaucracy, there's an awful lot of people that come to work and do the best they can and are good people, and there's a few people that maybe shouldn't be there, and there's probably some duplication of effort, and we all know that. But the question is, how bad does it get? And then, you know, now we have everybody saying, fire all these guys, none of them ever show up and work again, everything's okay. Well, come on. I mean, we seem to have, now we're on the total flip side of this. We don't believe anything anybody says, and I don't know where we get with this. You know, just, I guess, I don't know if that's a question necessarily, but now we have, you know, Trump wants to tear a lot of it down, and I think to a certain extent, you can't not say that some of it's justified. The style is not exactly my style, but I think it works with a lot of people. I mean, does anybody going to know any of this stuff about Hunter Biden? Does anybody know anything of the stuff about the real story behind Ukraine? I mean, does anybody ever get to know any of this crap?
Well, it's out there. Let's take Hunter Biden and Ukraine. The chief investigator, in a sense, who facilitated Rudy Giuliani's and the Trump administration's contacts with Ukrainian authorities, is someone named Lev Parnas, and he was arrested, sent to prison for related scams, but he came out and wrote a terrific book that I've got here, Shadow Diplomacy, in which he says there was never really any dirt on Hunter Biden, and Parnas set up all the interviews. The main dirt is he was a drug addict who liked to have sex with escorts and prostitutes, among others. And yeah, we kind of know that. He also was getting money that, you know, in some of his, you know, pay for play type of situations. But there was never any stuff that would lead to a conviction, because most people on boards of directors, a lot of them, they're VIP types. Either.
Well, Andrew, back up. When we send money, the government of the U.S. of A. sends money kind of anywhere, I always get the feeling that it was almost like the carpetbaggers in the Civil War. American interests follow that money, and it doesn't always get to necessarily where we
exactly
are sending it to.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my, I won't say roommate because he was in the suite next door, a gentleman from, I think he was Guatemala, I'm not positive, one of those places down there, San Sal. I mean, it's been a long time, Kevin will remember, but his family was, you know, when they changed regimes, his family didn't know if they had to get the hell out or not, but they got him out. He was at Notre Dame, and I think we were helping whatever place that was out. This is 50 years ago. The place is still messed up. I bet his family's still in trouble, and a lot of our money went there, and I bet a lot of our people followed it down there and got a piece of it. And is this just so, is Hunter just another one of those people?
I think he never would have been prosecuted if his father wasn't running for president. So he's a drug addict who had a gun for 10 days. This is not, there's hundreds of thousands of people who could be prosecuted on that. And he didn't use the gun. It was clearly amplified by 1,000 times to damage his father's reelection campaign.
We'll stay on this.
That doesn't mean he shouldn't have been investigated and maybe even prosecuted, But if you're going to use that criteria, there's vast numbers of others, and the same thing with the tax. The ultimate payoff scandal, like you say, they didn't have the goods any more than they have on the Guatemalan situation or thousands of other situations.
It's just when people, it starts to wear on the populace in terms of who can you trust. I mean, we're way past that. The idea that everybody's a crook, and if you're not cheating, you're not trying. That's a different world than the one I grew up in, and it's kind of troubling to me personally. I'd be honest with you. And I think it is for you guys, or you wouldn't be doing the stuff you're doing. I mean,
no, it's very bad for democracy. Another brief comment about something that you said and Wayne said. If the Chicago Tribune, New York Times, and Washington Post would do at least some honest stories about the JFK investigation, that would pop that problem, pop that balloon. But they can't bring themselves to do honest reporting, on the one hand, on the other hand, normal stories about some of these things, because it would hurt their brand name to say, gee, 50, 60 years later, we're going to finally do the facts. And the facts, I just moderated the main research conference in the country on an annual conference in November on JFK assassination, including on potential disclosures of the documents in Dallas. There's no smoking gun in there. They're playing games with it. The media's playing games. There's no scientific or logical basis to think that Oswald could have killed Kennedy alone. And yet the New York Times and Washington Post have never done a story to that effect. And now we've got the kind of problems that you mentioned coming up to the present time, because every idiot with a conspiracy theory now feels justified in tearing apart our country's trust in government and media.
Andy, I would add that some of those idiots who come up with conspiracy theories are holding elective office right now.
Well, you guys are closer to this than me. We always have this, when Maddie was our producer, we'd have this constant argument, discussion regarding the state of the news media today. And the younger people are convinced because I love it too. The fact that I can go on the internet and find stuff in a second. I mean, come on. We used to have to go down to the library, right? I mean, I get it. But it seems to me that there's less content. I mean, we used to have four newspapers in Chicago with all these reporters getting paid, and now we have essentially one and a half. And what is the state, if somebody actually wants to write some serious articles for the Tribune or the Washington Post, is there a budget for them? Do they hire the guy? I mean, Mike Royko ever be get a job today? I mean, what is the state of the industry?
Well, let me mention thing, and I'll give Wayne a great punchline that pulls all this together. But the first money I got was from the Chicago Daily News, Chicago Tribune, as a college student, as a stringer. They paid me $100, and I basically did almost nothing on a story. I later worked 14 years for the Hartford Courant. When I left, there were 230 reporters. There's about 15 now, 230 to 15.
Well,
they can't cover things. This is the Hartford Courant. I think it's got the same ownership as the Tribune. They're just trying to get money out of it. They don't care about the news. They won't pay for the news, so why should subscribers pay them? But Wayne's got a great, and they can't cover what's needed for democracy, but Wayne's got a great story. Tell me your Ben Bradley funeral story.
Well, I was at speaking of the White House, I attended Pierre Salinger's funeral back in 2004. I had met Salinger and talked to him several times on stories of mutual interest.
And who was he, Wayne?
Pierre Salinger had been the press secretary for President Kennedy. He had been a reporter for San Francisco. I think it was the Chronicle. Afterwards, he wound up as a foreign correspondent for ABC News, based in Paris. And so I'm leaving Holy Trinity Church, which is on the campus of Georgetown University, where they.
He was also Kennedy's speechwriter, wasn't he?
He wasn't the speechwriter, but he was the press secretary. Ted Sorensen was Kennedy's chief speechwriter.
Right.
And he may have actually been at this funeral also. And I'm leaving, and I find myself walking down the street towards Wisconsin Avenue. There with Ben Bradley, who was the managing editor of the Post during Watergate, played by I believe it was Jason Robards in the movie All the President's Men, and his A-list wife Sally Quinn, who put on these big A-list parties in D.C. And Ben Bradley, he looks over, he says something like, "Oh, it was a nice service." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "How do you know Pierre?" And I told him, we worked on a couple stories together. And I'm thinking, here's Ben Bradley, the great friend Ben Bradley. And then he says, "Who are you with?" And I said, "Well, I'm a freelancer." And I thought, well, gee, maybe he'll hand me his card and say, "Hey, give this guy at the Post a call." What he hit me back with was the typical Washington response: "Good luck with that." "Good luck with that." And how do you take that? Well,
we had a dude who was on the show here a few times, and I'd like to get him back. But he was covering murders in Chicago. He'd head out by himself at 3 a.m. when he had a police blotter. And I said to the dude one day, I forget his name, I go, "Well, you're working for the Tribune." He goes, "Oh, no. I'm working for myself. I get a story and I try to sell the story," because they don't have anybody out there.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. So Wayne is going to call his memoirs "Good Luck With That," because it's blowing him off, but in a pseudo-friendly way. And so Wayne's the author of 25 books, a daily column, appeared in broadcast commentator on every TV network and cable. And the guy, actually Ben Bradley, was executive editor then, who could have said, "Oh, what do you write about?" Or says, "Good luck with that."
So let me get this straight. Were either one of you guys ever invited to one of these A-list parties?
I actually was. My first week in Washington, first couple of weeks, somebody gave me a thing, a big party. They had Alan Greenspan, the publisher of the Washington Post, was there, and I thought, really, I've made it here, and never again.
What is the? We only got a couple of minutes, but what has been the change when these big companies essentially start owning these papers? We all know that. I mean, we all suspect that there's some sort of a breeze coming from on high. What are the guys saying in Casablanca? "I go with the wind, and the wind's blowing from Vichy." I mean, does everybody know what Bezos thinks before they write an article or something these days?
Well, Bezos definitely has put his imprimatur on the Post, because they've had several resignations there. And same thing with the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. They had a couple resignations because the owner, he's a South African born, and he basically has been spiking articles. Bezos and this LA Times owner refused to let the papers make an endorsement in the presidential election. So yeah, it's getting a much worse, I think, for editorial independence with these owners. Now, news, as you know, with the McCormick in Chicago, yes, it was always corporate ownership, but there at least was an attempt, and you could argue whether it was a serious attempt, to keep a wall between the corporate owner and the editorial decisions of the newspaper.
I always thought when I was very young, I always thought, I mean, I'm a, as you know, my thing is, well, is managing money for people and trading, but I'm, you know, I'm kind of a half-assed economist. I've kept up with it, and I studied under some pretty good guys. I always thought that the thing that kept these papers in line was the fact that we had four papers. If the Tribune did something really stupid in the morning, the Daily News loved to talk about it in the afternoon.
Exactly. And
reminds me of the Billy Goat Tavern.
Yeah.
Yeah. A quick thing, and I know you're running out of time, so, but the first high-profile person to quit the Post, Robert Kagan, a columnist, he said, "I'm not quitting over the interference with the endorsement." He says, "That's the tip of the iceberg." And he said, "I'm quitting the Post." And he was kind of a conservative, Robert Kagan. He said, "What we know internally is it's much worse than just whether they endorse for president. Nobody cares that much."
Well, isn't the LA Times the same people in the Tribune, right?
Yeah. No. The LA Times, at one point, under Times Mirror, they were together, but an independent rich guy who, Sung, I think Wayne mentioned his name, he bought it, and these billionaires who buy this stuff are first looked on as saviors, but the problem, that's a huge problem, is that they have other interests that are vastly more important than putting out the news to them. And so in the case of Bezos, he's got billions of government contracts.
Yeah.
Whereas just a $250 million investment in the Post, but Trump killed a $10 billion Amazon contract in the first term. And so there's these, again, hidden agendas by the owners of all of these major media, virtually.
Well, we're going to have you guys back on. This stuff is interesting. I'm happy to see you guys are both around. If you're ever in Chicago, I'd love to have you in the studio like you came last time.
Absolutely.
But you guys take care of yourself. And I'm going to, you know, be emailing you from time to time, and because this stuff's not going to go away. It's interesting stuff. And thank you, dudes. SP Futures up 22. NASDAQ Futures up 149. What do you think about now you can book your Bitcoin profit even if you didn't sell it, so it's $600 million to Tesla in a quarter. That's a real number. Greg, good job. It was a tough one today getting everybody in. I'll be back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.